from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A White House spokesman says President Obama is considering sending humanitarian aid to Syrians while at the same time ramping up pressure against Syrian President Bashar Assad. Growing sectors of the Syrian population have mounted demonstrations against the Assad regime, sparking violent government crackdowns resulting in thousands of deaths. The United States and several Gulf countries have closed their embassies and recalled their diplomats, and we'll discuss the next steps in the region after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Citing escalating mayhem, the United States closed its embassy in Syria on Monday, and on Saturday, United Nations Security Council vetoes by China and Russia ensured the defeat of an Arab League peace plan to deal with the ongoing carnage and torture under Syrian leader Bashar Assad. Thousands have been killed in Syria since conflict and unrest began back in March of 2011, following the uprising in Tunisia. And the city of Homs has been under bombardment for five consecutive days. The overall crackdown in Syria has brought international condemnation and the closing of other embassies besides the American embassy. Presence of observers from the Arab League did nothing to quell the violence. The observers pulled out and Syria was expelled from the Arab League. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we turn our attention to the ongoing crisis in Syria and consider what, if any, actions are available to stem the tide of blood in what has become, by many accounts, a civil war. I want to first go to New York City and welcome Richard Haass, who is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. They are a nonpartisan organization focused on foreign policy issues. He was senior director for policy planning for the State Department under George W. Bush. And welcome, Richard Haass.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to have you with us. It seems like Syria increasingly becoming more isolated and diplomatic channels of all kinds failing, although we have a Russian foreign minister there, Sergei Lavrov, and he's talking about some kind of way of moving out of this impasse. Any hope on that score?
I don't think so. I think the Russians and Mr. Lavrov are more engaged in damage control. The Russian veto in the United Nations alienated them from much of the world and many of the Arab countries in particular. And I think the Russians are basically now trying to undo some of their self-inflicted damage.
Well, let's talk about the vetoes for a moment, because, as you said, there's certainly been a strong reaction. Some say it's emboldened Assad and Syria to take even a stronger hand and become more violent. But it's also maybe given the Syrian army a gaining of strength.
I thought Mr. Assad was plenty bold to begin with, and he didn't need the events in New York to unleash him, if you will, on his own citizens. What I think is it sends a message that the UN is not going to be front and center here, and probably you won't have some kind of a large-scale concerted international response. Ironically, another reaction was felt in Israel, where it looked at what happened here, saw what happened or didn't happen in the United Nations, and for many Israelis it sent the message that they can't count on the UN or the international community for dealing with their biggest foreign policy fixation, which is not Syria, but rather Iran. So it's interesting to me how these things have unintended consequences.
Well, also, maybe not so surprising to hear Erdogan of Turkey say that this has given Assad more of a license to kill. Turkey at one time was a pretty close ally of Syria's.
It was, and one of the most interesting developments here is Turkey's dramatic distancing from Syria, and increasingly Turkey could be critical here. And the two most interesting regional countries in some ways are Turkey and Iran, obviously arrayed on different sides here. They both have fairly large stakes given the potential for refugees, the Kurdish population inside Syria, which could affect their own their own domestic cohesiveness. And in some ways, this becomes a bit of a proxy battle for regional influence. If you think about it, Syria has the potential to become something like Lebanon was three or four decades ago, something like Iraq was several years ago. It becomes something of a Middle East battleground where regional powers increasingly pursue their own ambitions and aims.
Well, the United States has been criticized for having its own interests, particularly vis-a-vis Iran and the close alliance that Iran and Syria have. In fact, Russians and Chinese gave as their reasoning behind their vetoes talk about Syria's sovereignty. And, I think it was President Putin who said that there's been support from the United States for the opposition in Syria, and that wasn't brought into light enough.
What I think is behind the Russian position is partially commercial. It's partially Putin's desire and Lavrov's desire often to stick it to the United States, to be blunt. But also the Russians and the Chinese, for that matter, are hypersensitive. Whenever this question of sovereignty comes up, they're always nervous about setting precedents. And their concern is always if the world is allowed to get involved in the quote-unquote internal affairs of Syria, does this not establish a dangerous precedent from their point of view, and the world could then take a larger role in what they would see as their own internal affairs, be it in China or Russia? So a lot of this is about the avoidance of patterns or precedents in international relations that they fear could come around to bite them.
Talking again with President of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, who's with us from New York. In the meantime, the city of Homs is getting bombarded. In fact, it started right after the Security Council vote, or almost the same day, and most recently, we've seen hundreds upon hundreds of not only adult men, but women and children, and it's all too reminiscent of Hama in 1982 under Bashar Assad's father, when 10,000 people were killed. What, if anything, diplomatically can stop this? Sanctions don't seem to work, and isolation of Syria doesn't seem to work.
I think the time has passed for a diplomatic resolution here. Too much blood has been spilled, so either this regime is going to survive or it's going to, by force, or it's going to be ousted. There's, I think, no chance there can be any kind of political accommodation at this point. I think it's too soon to give up on sanctions, in the sense that if you have growing economic isolation of Syria on top of the diplomatic isolation, it could cause people within the country, in the Sunni merchant class — the Sunnis are the plurality of the people there in that part of the population — to distance themselves from the regime. It may encourage certain army units to defect. And also, the other thing going on, the other dynamic, is clearly the arming of opposition elements, the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is not quite an army, but again, does represent opposition.
So kind of a ragtag bunch, really, isn't it?
At the moment, absolutely. And arms are reaching them from several Arab countries, as well as from Turkey.
And the United States.
So my guess is that I don't think the United States, unless you know something.
Well, this is what Russia has charged of, at least.
Well, I don't know. I have not seen that. I don't believe we are in that business, because if the United States were to go down that path, if you arm people and they get in trouble, then you're much more on the hook to come to their aid. So I do not believe, unless, again, the United States is doing something covertly that I don't know about.
Well, I was going to say, using surrogates possibly, no?
But again, the Turks, the Guterres, and others are getting arms to people, and I think what you're seeing is not yet quite a civil war, but the setting of the stage for it. And it's quite possible that the dynamic will be one side, the government backed by Iran, indirectly by Russia; the other side, you'd have opposition elements backed by Turkey and several of the Sunni Arab countries. And that could set the stage for something of a prolonged armed struggle.
Well, plus this government in exile, the Syrian National Council, the opposition group, has endorsed foreign intervention, and they may, one can presume, ask for military assistance. Where can it come? Can it come from NATO, for example?
I don't think it will come from NATO. I don't think, again, it will come from the United States. There's different kinds of military assistance, but I've yet to see anyone put forward what looks to me like a coherent plan for military intervention. So I think the most likely thing for the time being, again, is you'd have arming of various elements. If you ever reached a point where you had part of Syria break away, you could have some kind of then safe haven, which conceivably could be protected. You could have humanitarian aid go in there. But we're a long ways away from that. I think the support the United States and others will be giving to Syrian opposition elements will largely be economic, humanitarian, or diplomatic.
We're not going to see anything like Iraq or Libya, obviously.
I do not. No.
As far as intervention, yeah.
Certainly nothing remotely like Iraq. I do not think we're going to see anything on the order of Libya, for many reasons. The demography of the country, the physical layout of the country, the politics of the country don't lend itself. Also, the Syrian army is far more capable. The Syrian Air Force is far more capable. Libya basically had no serious national military institutions or capabilities. Syria actually does have air defense. It has an air force. It has a serious army, serious security forces. So this would be something far more demanding. I'm not saying in principle it couldn't be overcome, but this would not be anything that would be small or light or easy. Libya would not be a very good metaphor or comparison.
Richard Hoskin is president of the Council on Foreign Relations and former director for policy planning of the State Department under President George W. Bush. Richard Haas, thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime, Michael.
I also want to bring in Dr. Mahmoud Khattab. He is here locally in the Bay Area. He's a medical doctor. He's also chairman of the Syrian American Council, and that is the biggest, or I should say largest, Syrian group in the United States. I should mention that Dr. Khattab has five cousins who have been killed in Homs. And Dr. Khattab, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thanks.
Well, this is certainly a human rights issue, and I know you and many of your brethren in your group are very concerned about this. We've seen failure of the Arab League. We've seen failure now of the United Nations. What would you like to see in place? And, I mean, I assume maybe something like a no-fly zone?
Well, I just heard Mr. Richard Haas talking about all options, and also he mentioned the sanctions. You know, the sanctions were imposed in the Syrian government about 10 months ago. I can tell you the sanctions will take long time to work. We know that Iran is supporting the Syrian regime. We have information that Assad has about $12 billion in Syria now. From expert information or reports, this money is enough for the Syrian government to maintain the support for the army for about a year, even if we stop all the resources to the Syrian government. The question is, can people on the ground running this uprising continue like this for 1 year? Absolutely not. So I think the international community and especially the U.S. administration have to face this, and we don't have to lose the momentum now. We have to do real actions. No-fly zone is one option. I'm not a military expert, but we have to think about this very seriously. Also, there are other options like safety zone, safety corridor.
That would be between Syria and Turkey.
That most likely will be between Syria and Turkey, but Turkey by itself shouldn't do it alone. This should be like international coalition, something similar to what happened during Kosovo. Now, many countries started to talk about something called Friends of Syria, and I just heard yesterday that Turkey Prime Minister called for international conference for Syria. So I think something will come up, but we have to realize that the sanctions by themselves are not sufficient to solve this situation in Syria.
Would you like, Dr. Khattab, let me rephrase it, what would you like the United States' role to be in this? We've had certainly condemnations from Ambassador Susan Rice, from Secretary Hillary Clinton, but they're talking about more sanctions, and President Obama has condemned what's going on in Syria and said more pressure needs to be brought, and he's talking about humanitarian aid. But you're speaking about something broader, about the United States being involved, I believe, in some kind of greater international action, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. I think United States is still the superpower. United States can play a significant role in that. And President Obama can do more. Again, he's still talking on the same line. He's still talking about sanctions, imposing more sanctions on the government. Bashar al-Assad has proved that he does not understand this language. I just heard reports a few days ago, credible reports, that Iran sent 15,000 soldiers to Syria. And they're supporting Assad by technology. They're supporting them by all means because they want to maintain this regime. Obviously, Assad has used the recent Russia and China veto as a green light to escalate the violence in Syria. We, you know, all the world noticed 2 days ago after the veto that the escalation, the violence in Homs especially, was much bigger. Assad has been shelling the city with heavy weapons, with tanks, for the last 2 days. Yesterday, over 125 people were killed in Homs. Today, I just heard the news, at least 60 people have been killed. So obviously, the United Nations Security Council is paralyzed by the recent veto, and we have to consider other options seriously. And as I said, U.S. should and can take the lead in this effort.
Yeah, the siege in Homs has been relentless, and I'm sorry and extend my sympathy to you because I know you've lost five members of your family. Dr. Khattab, I appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Mahmoud Khattab is medical doctor and chairs the Syrian American Council. I'll tell you who's going to be with us for the rest of the hour. Cole Buchenfeld is director of advocacy for the Project on Middle East Democracy, which promotes democratic reform in the Middle East. He's with us from Washington, D.C., and welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thanks very much.
We also have Hisham Ahmed with us, professor of politics at St. Mary's College, California, here in the Bay Area. He's with us this morning from Moraga. Welcome. Good to have you.
Pleasure to be with you, Michael.
Professor Ahmed, let me begin with you. This just gets more brutal, relentlessly brutal. How can we stop the bloodshed, and what can we do to stop the bloodshed from your perspective?
Well, I'm afraid that there might be no magic solution at this moment. This is a very brutal regime. It has savagely been involved in genocidal acts against its own people. It has committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, systematically for the past four decades. Therefore, things might take some time. However, I am in favor, as a matter of fact, of tightening more sanctions and diplomatic isolation against this regime. I think exposing this regime for what it is, out on the street, especially in the Arab world, in every capital in the world, will certainly bring it down. Even further, I think the most effective way to deal with this crisis is through what I call the Arab solution. The Arab League needs to do a lot more than it has done thus far. Sending monitors, obviously, would not do the job. There is a precedent, Michael, back in 1976, when there was a civil war in Lebanon, the Arab League then authorized the very Syrian regime to send its troops to Lebanon under the rubric of the Arab Deterrence Forces, ostensibly to troubleshoot the civil war, to try to maintain some order and stability in Lebanon. Of course, they did something else. They did the reverse. But in other words, there is a precedence upon which the Arab League can operate today with regard to the Syrian crisis. I think the United States can use much of its leverage and influence on a number of Arab countries, on the Arab League itself, to see to it that the Arab League is involved in a more concerted, more effective set of measures to put an end to this act of genocide that is taking place on a daily basis.
Well, it's not only an act of genocide. There's been a lot of characterization of this as being on the brink of a civil war. I think at this point, it is a civil war, isn't it?
In many respects, it is. But you see, this is what needs to be brought to a halt right away. The more intensified a civil war is in Syria, the more gratified the regime becomes. In other words, this regime thrives on divisions, on splits, on having different groups fighting against each other. This is what it instrumentally and very skillfully did in Lebanon, to play different groups against each other, to arm and support different groups against each other. Therefore, I think all efforts need to be expended at this stage to try to see to it that no full-fledged civil war takes place in Syria. This regime needs to be isolated for what it is. It is a representative of a tiny minority in Syrian society. Even the Alawites today, the sect to which this regime belongs, came out today in a very strong statement condemning what's happening, especially in Homs, and saying that the actions of the regime do not represent their sect. Therefore, this regime is basically tribally based. It is based on a handful of individuals around Bashar, who, as a matter of fact, is detached, really, from the overall reality of what's going on around him. It can be isolated. I think we are not to rule out the possibility of some high-ranking army officers splitting from the regime, and perhaps they are the ones who need to be counted on for some serious action to fundamentally change the current status quo.
Let me go to Cole Bockenfeld on this. You know, Bashar Assad gave an interview to Barbara Walters, and he said the majority of the people are not necessarily behind him, but they are certainly in favor of the regime, or they're not against the regime. What we know now, I suspect, Cole Bockenfeld, is that maybe the majority is against this regime.
Yeah, I think at this point, the opposition, the majority of the people have clearly shifted to the opposition. But, you know, as a number of the guests before previously mentioned, the opposition is a fragmented force, and this means several different things. Of course, there's the political opposition with the Syrian National Council. There's more the military opposition with the Free Syrian Army. And then there's others included in the local coordinating committees, which is much more the youth movement that are organizing protests and organizing kind of ad hoc confrontations. So this is also kind of a fragmented opposition, which hampers the ability for them to act really strongly in one voice.
And there's division between the military and political wings, particularly, isn't there?
There is, and that's intentionally so, and I think part of that is a result of calls from the U.S. For the opposition to stay peaceful, and I think it's very much so far in the U.S. interest that those two stay as separate tracks, based very much on the examples from Libya, where, you know, there was also sort of ragtag militia and rebel groups fighting Gaddafi's military forces. But there was also a political face with a National Transitional Council as well. And so I think they, at this point, would still much prefer those to be separate tracks. But at the same time, there needs to be some increased coordination between the two bodies.
It appears that there's very little chance of the United States intervening in the way that it did with Libya. I mean, there were no boots on the ground, but it was an intervention. And we're not going to see anything comparable in Syria. So what do you see the United States' position in this? Just more sanctions and more tough talk?
Well, I think the first part is going to be more sanctions. And I would say, you know, the sanctions are difficult because they take a lot of time to work. And, you know, we also have to remember the sanctions aren't necessarily targeted at Assad personally. I don't think he, you know, really responds to that in a way that we would like to see. But it's also very important to kind of weaken the existing pillars of support that he does have. And that includes the Sunni merchant class, who is still tacitly supporting the regime. If you had that kind of major segment of society switch sides to the opposition, it would have a major impact and kind of speed things along a little bit quicker.
Let's talk just a bit for a moment about where his support is coming from, because you see these throngs in Damascus when the Russian foreign minister is there. They were out in large numbers as if, you know, there is, and I know that's orchestrated, but as if there's tremendous support. But it's mainly the military security forces and the business elite who are Sunnis and Christians.
Yes, I'd say that's correct. Of course, the Sunni merchant class has a lot of vested interest in this regime, and, you know, they're worried in a sense that if this regime were to fall, if those interests would be protected. So at this point, I think most of them are still hedging their bets on sticking with Bashar. With the ethnic minorities, it's a similar story. You know, it's Christians, Assyrians, several other Maronite groups, etc., that also fear, you know, what a future Syrian government would look like, and a majority government would be very Sunni dominated, where they feel that they would really be cracked down on. So for them, I think they've made the conclusion that it's kind of a lose-lose at this point, and have so far been very hesitant to get off the fence.
Cole Bockenfeld with us from Washington, Director of Advocacy Project on Middle East Democracy. You can join us as well, and I want to open the phone lines and invite you to do that. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Any questions or comments you may have on the ongoing crisis in Syria and what ought to be done or what can be done, join us, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Saturday, there was a failure of a UN resolution put forward by the Arab League to bring to some resolve, or at least bring to some halt, the ongoing crisis in Syria, which for the last 5 days has involved bombardment of the city of Homs. Many deaths. In fact, going back to March 2011, the situation in Syria has just grown more and more violent. There's a ragtag army of about 10,000 rebels in opposition to the Bashar Assad regime. And a White House spokesman says that President Obama is considering sending humanitarian aid while there is ramping up pressure against President Bashar Assad. growing sectors of the Syrian population have mounted demonstrations against the regime, and there have been violent government crackdowns, thousands of deaths. We're talking about all that, and I should also mention the United States and several Gulf countries, and now members of the EU, have closed their embassies and have recalled their diplomats. What next to do is really the question underlying our discussion here this morning. Richard Haass was with us earlier, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. With us for the hour, Dr. Mahmoud Khattab, who is a medical doctor and chairs the Syrian-American Council. Hisham Ahmed, who is professor of politics at St. Mary's College of California, and Cole Bockenfeld, who is director of the Advocacy Project on Middle East Democracy, which promotes democratic reform in the Middle East. I want to go right to your phone calls, and let's go first to Amina and El Sarita. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'd first just like to say that this is not a civil war, because you basically have an entire civil population who's being bombarded day and night, so that cannot be equivalent to a civil war. Secondly, the Russians continue to talk about outside intervention, and they're totally against that, and yet they continue to arm the Syrian regime. I've heard that just yesterday, with the visit of the Russian minister, he brought missiles with him. And we also know that Iranis and the Hezbollah are continuing to arm the Syrian people. So to talk about outside intervention, there already is outside intervention, and this really reminds me of Bosnia, when there was an arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims while the Serbs had access to one of the largest armies in Europe. So this is definitely a genocide. It is not a civil war, and the UN has really lost its mandate to prevent these kind of situations.
The UN does have a mandate to protect, a responsibility to protect. Amina, thank you for that call. Cole Bockenfeld, the distinction between genocide and civil war here?
Yeah, well, I think at this point, with the growth of the Syrian, the Free Syrian Army and their forces, it could become a civil war. I wouldn't characterize it as such just yet. But with the failure of diplomacy, the UN Security Council, I think a lot of Syrians on the ground are really looking at this like that. This is now the option that they have to fight their own fight. And I think the U.S. will continue to pursue diplomatic means and continue to pursue kind of this Friends of Syria group, a coalition of regional neighbors, mostly led by Turkey, to see what other kinds of support we can provide. But I think this is the path that we're going down.
And we go next to Hugh. Hugh, you're on with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Wanted to talk about China's role in all this a little bit. They have been supportive of the dictatorship in Syria previously, the same right up till the end with Muammar Gaddafi. And for the democracies, once they do become the newly emerged democracies, they are going to have continued economic challenges, which will undermine them with not being able to compete with artificially low-cost labor and products being dumped from China. And yet many citizens in the Arab countries consider the U.S. to be the great Satan and the challenges. What about China's role in all this?
Well, Professor Ahmed, some thoughts from you on China and their veto?
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the greatest accomplishments that this savage regime thinks it has really achieved is to play a role in polarizing the world in a manner reminiscent of the Cold War era. It is quite disturbing, as a matter of fact, to see such a regime able to play this divisive role in the world. Therefore, I think China and Russia have their own reasons, which one has to understand, not to agree with, has to understand for why they cast the veto power in the Security Council. Accordingly, if one understands that, perhaps some differences between the United States on the one hand and Russia and China on the other can and should be ironed out in order to further isolate this regime. I think what the Russians and the Chinese were saying by their veto is that they were not really happy and pleased by the turn of events in Libya. That is, China, for its part, feels that it has lost so many interests in Libya in terms of trade and what have you. Russia feels that it has lost some of its arms sale deals in Libya. And I think what they are saying in the Syrian case is that they don't want to lose more interests. Now, China's trade with the Syrian regime is minimal, as a matter of fact, if compared with its trade with even some of the smallest countries country in the Gulf area. So China does not have too much involvement in Syria other than to send a signal, I think, to the United States that it was not too happy with the way things were handled in Libya. Now, Russia, on the other hand, has a lot of interests, historic interests in Russia, in Syria, and I think this is the time really for effective, very skillful U.S. diplomacy to iron out differences with these two countries, to try to find commonalities of interests between Russia, China, and the United States in order to further isolate this regime. And this is doable, in my view.
Yeah, it is, as you said initially, all too reminiscent of Cold War geopolitics. Here's a listener who writes, grave mistake on the part of Russia and China to obstinately stand on the wrong side of the Middle Eastern history and the world's largest oil reserve. Russia and China are convincing their people that Assad is fighting Muslim terrorists. Russia compares them wrongly to the Chechens, while China to the Uyghur, to justify their support for a tyrant who is slaughtering his people. And Dr. Mahmoud Khattab is also with us and is head of the biggest Syrian group here in the United States, chairs it, and is a medical doctor here in the Bay Area, the Syrian American Council. Dr. Khattab, I wonder how you respond to this listener, Salam, who says, your conversation this morning is a fraud. You have on instigators for war against Syria, yet you don't even question the premise of the United States being involved in an internal conflict, notwithstanding the fact that the United States is orchestrating the uprising using proxies, including Salafists, that is Saudi terrorists, formerly known as Wahhabis, and other minions of the CIA.
Well, I think that's extension to Bashar al-Assad propaganda in Syria. And he's been spreading this from March 15 when the uprising started, and he has been talking about armed groups, about people working for U.S. agencies, for Israeli agencies, and at the same time, he's closing the country. There is no foreign media in Syria to support this idea, and everybody knows that it's all about people in Syria that are asking for freedom and democracy. In fact, Syrian people are asking U.S. to do more, because as we all know, U.S. administration so far has only imposed sanctions on Syria, so the response to Libya was totally different, either from U.S. or from NATO or the international community. And nobody can claim that U.S. is behind this revolution. In fact, U.S. in the past 30 or 40 years has supported some dictators, unfortunately, like Hosni Mubarak and Ben Ali in that area. And I think it is the time now for U.S. to take momentum and to support really people on the ground. And I'm not underestimating what President Obama and the administration has done so far, but what I'm saying, they can do more, and they can really prove to the Syrian people that they are on the side of the Syrian people, not with dictatorship, and they can support them with doing real actions on the ground. And I'm not saying they have to send soldiers, but at least they have to do action, like creating international coalition and helping Turkey in that regard, to creating safety zone, and that will change a lot of things on the ground. Also, yesterday, Senator McCain talked about arming the Free Syrian Army, and we have been involved with the administration, actually, in that regard. They have many questions, as all of us, about the Free Syrian Army. But I think at least this is something that you have to be taken into consideration, and engaging with the Free Syrian Army and trying to support them.
Dr. Khattab, I wonder what you think also about another listener who sends this comment on our website. This is Wayne, who writes, who says he's applying logic here. He says, Bashar Assad won't step down. The protesters won't back down. There are effectively two countries, so why not, in order to avoid a worsening civil war, partition Syria into two countries, one for Assad and his thugs and one for a free Syria?
Well, that doesn't make any sense. Actually, the opposition and people inside Syria, including the Alawis, nobody is talking about splitting Syria to two or three countries. Then if you want to do that, we might as well split it to small country for Christian, small country for Druze. There's many ethnic groups in Syria. And it makes a lot of sense to keep the unity of the country. And that's not the solution, to give him his own, country. And as many people have been listening to, supporter of Bashar al-Assad, they call it Syria al-Assad. So it's not for one person or one family. Syria is for its own people. And in fact, if you listen to the people who are on the ground, and to the Syrian National Council, to the Free Syrian Army, to the oppositions abroad, everybody says that we want civil state. We want a state that has equal rights to everybody, to Sunni, Alawi, Christian. That's what the official position for the opposition and the SNC. So I think it makes a lot of sense to keep the unity of Syria and not to respond to one person and give him his own country.
And again, Mahmoud Khattab is the chair of the Syrian American Council. If you'd like to join us in the time remaining, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page, or go to our web site, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And more of your comments and questions. Roberto, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I wanted to say a comment and then a question, please. A comment is that we have not heard the facts that Syria in the 1950s and the early 60s was in the Middle East, quote, the land of revolution. You never knew what flag was going to rise. So the present regime did stay in power for a long time under the banner, do you want civil war, revolution, or do you want some sort of stability? And with that having been said, though, I understand the UN's involvement at this point. But I believe at some point in time, the United Nations has to prove that it's an establishment that is going to function and function as it should and to help to resolve these problems. Or then we're going to have to look for a different formation to have this problems addressed. It should not be just one country, the United States or the Russia or China. There's the EU. There are many countries. Brazil is a much large country that has much influence. So would Australia and Canada and such. So this should be a united effort. And there has to be some sort of movement where, all right, we're going to lock the doors until you work this out. Or then we'll look potentially towards disbanding and forming another organization. We either give this organization the power and the authority to resolve these issues peacefully, both commercially, economically, and the cost of life and limb, or it is a puppet front that pecks away at small problems and eventually overcomes very little.
Well, the Security Council, thank you for that, is really immobilized by the vetoes, as we've been indicating in this conversation. I'm not sure. What would you say, Professor Ahmed, about the possibility of some kind of international unity outside of the frame of the United Nations and a concerted effort on that score, like President Bush the First did in Kuwait?
Well, you know, I do think that still there is room and there is the possibility for working through the United Nations. After all, there are some serious war crimes and crimes against humanity that are taking place, and there is the need for humanitarian intervention by the United Nations. I would strongly suggest that action should and can be conducted regarding the Syrian crisis by the United Nations. That provides more legitimacy, I think. That makes it more convincing for the Syrian people, for the Arabs, and for, you know, other peoples around the world. Any unilateral action, I think, by the United States would have the reverse effect at this stage. Just to make a quick comment on what Roberto said, it is absolutely true that this regime has maintained some degree of stability in Syria for about 3.5 decades, you know, since its rise to power in 1970. But that stability really was done by deceitful ideology, was done by tribal and partisan manipulation. It has been done exclusively by reliance on brute force. And I think everybody knows, including the regime itself, including some of its very few supporters in Syria today, that its days are numbered. The question is how and what next, you know, after the downfall of the Bashar al-Assad regime. This is the time, I believe, for every conscientious human being, human rights organization, to step in,
to expose the regime for what it is, and I have no doubt in my mind that the power of moral force will be strong enough to bring this vicious regime down sooner than we think, Michael.
Hisham Ahmed, again, is professor of politics at St. Mary's College of California, and Cole Buchenfeld is director of the Advocacy Project on Middle East Democracy. I've got a listener here. Cole Buchenfeld is talking about something being said on the air, unless I have amnesia, I honestly don't remember, about Iranian troops being sent to fight the opposition. But let's talk about Iran's role in all this, because Iran has been, and I would include Hezbollah, a very close and ongoing ally of the Assad regime. And there's certainly a kind of tug of war going on between the United States and Iran over the nuclear issue. How much does that play into this whole picture?
Well, I think it makes it immensely more complicated. Syria, of course, because of the links to Hezbollah and Iran, but, you know, it's a very important piece for the United States in the Middle East. You know, it's the most important country through which Iran projects its power into the Arab world. So for a lot of people that really want to take a much more active and interventionist approach to Syria, it's to really take a strike at Iran indirectly. I think also, though, it really complicates things. I haven't seen evidence that there are Iranian troops on the ground, but a lot of our Syrian contacts are reporting that there have been you know, all kinds of support provided to the Syrian security forces from the Iranians. And yes, of course, a lot of rumors of Iranians themselves active in the crackdown. So it is possible that they're also participating in it, but it complicates things and really stokes a lot of rumors of proxy wars and these kind of things that really cautions people against any kind of hasty action.
And here's a comment on our website from a listener named Brian who says, aren't we running the risk of picking sides in a regional sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shias? The U.S. has turned its back on Bahrain's Shias to avoid alienating a repressive Sunni minority regime that rules Bahrain, as well as alienating our allies in Sunni Saudi Arabia. Now we are encouraging tough action against the Alawite Shias who rule a very diverse Syria. We are being selective in our outrage and at best, and hypocritical at worst. Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go to Charlie next. Charlie, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum. I'm sorry, Charlie, are you there? No? Okay, then we'll go to another caller, and that's Colin. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to follow through on the comments made by the online commenter. If it were a rebellion by the Shiites in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi regime were massacring its own population, would the U.S. government impose sanctions against the Saudis and seek U.N. resolutions condemning the Saudi government? I'm not condoning what the Syrian government is doing, but I think we need to take this with a grain of salt.
Well, what about that point? Let me go to you on this again, Professor Ahmed. The idea that the United States and Syria have crossed swords much more than the United States has, let's say, with Saudi Arabia, who's been a very close ally.
Well, you know, one cannot really say no to this. Regrettably, there has been quite a considerable degree of selectivity in U.S. policy with regard to different issues, you know, in the Arab world and in the Middle East. There have been double standards. Yes, Bahrain has been involved in the repression of its people. And because, you know, these people are Shiites, there hasn't been much really action by the United States or the international community for that matter. Yemen. You know, the Yemeni president, Saleh. He's a real war criminal. And unfortunately, we do host him here under the rubric of, you know, medical treatment. So, yes, of course, that doesn't justify in any way whatsoever what the Syrian regime is doing. But I think in the United States, we'll have to be quite cautious and quite careful in how to really project its policies to the Arab world, especially at this very critical moment, because emotions are high, there is so much sensitivity, and this is why I said the room is quite open for the United Nations to act. Any unilateral action by the United States will really have the reverse effects as far as Syria is concerned.
Let me bring Susan on. Susan, join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, thank you. And what I'd like to see is anything short of military intervention. I'd like to see any kind of diplomatic forces in, you know, brought to bear, including suspension of commercial flights and, at this point, a complete academic and cultural boycott, because I think that Syrians are being polarized mistakenly, but Bashir is not the polarizing force. I think it's more about economic and culturally privileged as opposed to the have-nots. And I think that if people understand, they're a lot like white South Africans who weren't really down with apartheid but did respond to diplomatic and cultural pressures. So I would like to see boycotts as well as humanitarian corridors established for the people who really need to leave. And I think that the withdrawal of Ambassador Ford was a very good and closing the diplomatic mission was a very good idea.
And are you in favor of President Obama lending aid to the Syrian, humanitarian aid to the Syrian people, as he said he would like to do?
What I'd like to see is the Assad family out, and anything that would help that and bring peace to that. I think that the senior academics and the cultural people in Syria are not necessarily Assad supporters.
Well, I thank you for that call. We're reminding you that you're listening to Forum, talking with Dr. Mahmoud Khattab and Hisham Ahmed and Cole Balkenfeld. We spoke earlier with Richard Haass. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll go to another caller, and we go to Menlo Park. Ma, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning to all of you. I want to say that what we are seeing right now in Syria is an internal affair of a country where people are divided on one region or another one. And I think the world should be careful before interfering in either way, including militarily. What we had seen is what has happened in Libya. It created a mess which is still going on. And I think it's wrong for us to think that countries like Saudi Arabia should be talking about democracy, who rule with the iron fist. And I also feel that the people who are talking over here, you can put them into the same way as what those people had talked when we were talking about Iraq, such as Iraq having nuclear bombs and so on. Interfering into an internal affair of a country creates nothing but mayhem, what we had seen in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Libya, where civil society has long been destroyed and what left is carnage and continuous war going on.
All right, thank you for your comments. Want to respond to that, Cole Balkenfeld?
Yes, I think it's important, in the larger picture of the Arab Spring here, that the world, and especially the U.S., is on the right side of history. At this point in time, I don't think it's any question if Bashar's regime will fall, but a matter of when. So it'll be important for whatever future government that takes its place that they're going to remember which countries came out in strong support when they needed it. And support, of course, takes a number of different forms, whether it's moral or political public support, or whether it's military or other logistical kind of action. It's, it'll be important for all of these countries to make very clear which side of events that they're on here.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails. Jason writes, is Russia only vetoing the UN bill because of the large arms sales and because Syria is the only player in the Mideast where Russia still has a major influence? Is this Russian pride holding back the action by the UN? I don't understand what interest China has. Are they merely flexing their muscles and using the fake terrorist excuse to get concessions on their other interests in the future negotiations with the UN? I spent 6 weeks in Syria in 1997. Lovely place, fantastic people. China and Russia should be ashamed they're allowing the slaughter to continue just for some poker chips in the big game. Another listener, Malcolm, writes, I've asked about this issue several times in the past and never heard a frank discussion about it. All these conflicts benefit the international arms industry and are very likely instigated by it. It would be a gift to the world if the arms industry enormous financial leverage was openly discussed and controlled, and if these profiteers were prosecuted as war criminals. Another listener says, please contrast the media coverage of the current Syrian actions and the actions in Gaza in 2009. How are the two situations different? Admittedly, both the Syrians and the Israelis targeted civilians. How has the American reaction been different? Some thoughts on that, Professor Ahmed?
That's the selectivity that we were just talking about. You know, there are double standards, unfortunately, held by the United States. You know, people of Palestine have been subjected to repression and oppression for so many years. I mean, you know, the occupation has really rendered every aspect of Palestinian life at the mercy of the occupation regime. But we don't hear much of this. This is almost a taboo in the media here. It is justifiably the case that, of course, there is so much coverage of the Syrian crisis, but there ought to be some equalization, I think, of treatment so that the U.S. credibility will be maintained in the region. Several, you know, callers talked about the role of or the policies of Saudi Arabia. It is true. There is an absolutely repressive regime that has been involved in oppressing its people, in rendering their freedoms and their rights almost null and void. We don't see much discourse on this here, and that ought to become definitely wide open for discussion.
All right, I want to get one more caller in here, and that's you, Chris. Thanks for waiting. Join us, please, on Forum.
Good morning. I'm just listening to all this thinking of Bashar al-Assad is going to do a repeat of what his father did some decades ago and completely crush the opposition, and all this talk about diplomacy, and all of that will be pointless because in a few days, these people could all wipe out. Is there any covert, any way to support these guys who are fighting on the ground?
Well, you've given us a pretty grim scenario, and we haven't talked about necessarily how the opposition can be helped specifically. The United States apparently doesn't want to get involved in this, and we'll have to continue to monitor what's going on in Syria. It's pretty grim. I want to thank our guests, Richard Haass with us earlier, President and Consul on Foreign Relations, Cole Balkenfeld, who is Director of the Advocacy Project on Middle East Democracy, Hisham Ahmed, Professor of Politics at St. Mary's College of California, and Dr. Mahmoud Khattab, the Chair of the Syrian American Council. Thank you, our listeners. Thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.